Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood, and welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we're joined, as always, by you, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
There are so very many things to talk about happening in the news right now. We're going to pick just one. That's the thing that happened today, because we're taping this on Tuesday, and it's, you know, 10-ish in the morning. How about that? Do you like that, Molly?
Yeah.
DACA, or DACA. I don't even know. It's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals plan that Attorney General Jeff Sessions this morning said, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to talk about what that means for businesses and the economy in this economy, because it's a lot.
Mm-hmm. We will very possibly discuss that at some length, but an imprecise length, because apparently that's what we're doing today. Kai's embracing imprecision.
I was told not to be specific with my time hacks, and so I am
I said I like it, and it never gets old, and you thought it was shade.
In a shade, side-eye, janky kind of way.
You couldn't even see my eyes. I'm all the way up here in Oakland.
Anywho.
We are going to have a conversation about that, and then we're going to have a chaser, which is that we'll be talking with Tim Leong, who is author of the coolest book about Star Wars, because we just want to do something fun.
Yeah.
We just want to.
First, though, obviously, the fix, the news fix. DACA. Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, as I just said, not DACA. No, that's the wrong one. President Trump announced via his Justice Department person, the Attorney General of the United States, Jefferson Sessions, this morning, that they're going to wind it down. It is being rescinded, is what Sessions said, a six-month grace period, and then it's all going to start going away. And it's interesting because along with that announcement came this from the president of the United States this morning, a tweet that said, Congress, get ready to do your job, DACA. So I think that means that he wants Congress to find some legislative approach that will ameliorate the effect of this decision that he made. That's my sense.
Oh, yeah. That seems to be the sense, which is that decisive action was not preferred. That there's a, you know, sort of a 6 month waiting period, and then hopefully Congress will do something about this. Now, Congress has many times before failed to do something about this. DACA, you're going to probably hear a lot of what is DACA, and we won't necessarily go all the way, but I will tell you that I was Googling it this morning, so it seems only fair to say that it was the program itself was created in 2012 under Barack Obama, and it essentially just defers deportment for children, for people who were brought here as children by their parents. And they had to have been younger than 31 in 2012 when the program started, and undocumented, which means they lack legal immigration status. They can't, you know, there's often the question about, well, why don't they just become citizens? And that's not an option. The DACA program doesn't give legal resident status at all. It does not offer any path to citizenship. It only defers deportment for, I think, 2 years at a time. So all by itself, it was a stopgap, to be generous. And it was created by executive policy decision by President Obama, which made it really easy to roll back. The path to citizenship part has been punted by Congress many times since, in fact, 2001, which is the first time that the so-called DREAM Act, I can't even remember what DREAM stands for, but I will Google it real quick while we Well, we talk, but the DREAM Act, Development, Relief, and Education for Alien Minors Act, was introduced in 2001. It was bipartisan then, but it has repeatedly failed to pass. So there's not a, I don't know. What do you think, Kai? Is there a lot of reason to hope that it will pass this time?
No. There are three things that I really want to point out about this, just in as I've been thinking about this the past couple of days. First of all, you know that thing where people sort of say tongue-in-cheek-wise, thanks, Obama, when something goes either wrong or right? So in all seriousness, on this today, I say, thanks, Obama, right? Because he did this via executive order, it can now be undone via executive order. Now, there's a whole lot of reasons that he did it, congressional intransigence, all of that stuff. But this is actually a defect in some of the policymaking decisions that have been happening in Washington. It is decidedly on the not normal side of our normal, not normal scale, right? This was an executive order that he did. It is now being undone by executive order. And that's just the fruits of the labor right here. You're seeing that happen.
To be honest, I'm not even sure it was an executive order. I think executive policy decisions are even milder than that. But I will say that this is a toot that I've been on for a while, which is,
don't
look,
do that. People are going to get upset.
The fact that you were, I don't care. I love it. Just own it. Owning it.
All right.
The fact that, look, I understand that President Obama's argument would be that he was dealt a raw deal by a Congress that absolutely refused to work with him and was utterly intransigent. But you know what? I'm a huge fan of that show. I'm the only person still watching Big Brother on CBS. And
wow,
I'm just saying,
you really are,
that there is always a deal to be made. And this is an administration that spent 8 years never building the inroads that it would have taken to solidify Obama's legacy and policies. And we are seeing the results of that now. And I have to believe that there was a form of arrogance in that all along. And now it is proving all too easy to sort of tear down those castles. And I do think that that's a huge failing.
Yep. Totally agree. So item one, thanks, Obama. Item two, as you pointed out, immigration reform is really hard. There's a reason we haven't done it since 1980, whatever the heck it was. And there is zero reason to believe that Congress is going to be able to do something about it this time. I don't actually see them being able to find their rear ends with both hands, as I've said in a more vernacular way many times in private conversation.
And has been floating around Twitter all day, the list of things that Congress has to take up right now. It's pretty long.
Well, right. No, totally. I mean, there's so much to do between the debt limit and hurricane relief and Irma's coming and now DACA. And oh, my God, there's so much they have to do. I'm not sure they can get there from here, which actually indirectly gets me to point number three, which is this. Microsoft came out today, and this is a really good indicator of how seriously corporate America is taking this. And there's some other things we can talk about, actually, corporate America-wise about this in a minute. But I think it's so interesting. Microsoft came out today and said, this, fixing DACA and taking care of these 800,000 people, is so important to us as a company that we think Congress should do this before it does tax reform, which is really fascinating because corporate America has been screaming for tax reform, screaming for tax reform for years now. And now they're saying, do this before that, which is telling.
And there is a huge economic impact. I mean, this certainly affects, there's sort of a distinction between the children who have come here now that are still children versus these dreamers. Most of it, like 97% of them, right, are either employed or in school.
Yeah.
There's some huge economic impact to deporting them. Many of them have started businesses. I mean, there's sort of all of these statistics that also indicate that in many ways there's zero reason to think that these are people who need to be deported from the United States of America in the first place. And the business response, which is kind of more in our wheelhouse, has been swift and virtually unanimous. I think you tweeted today, Kai, that you know, I challenge anyone to find me a business who is in favor of
still
this
waiting.
Move.
I'm still waiting on that press release from the company who says, yes, this was a great idea. Do more of this.
Even the Republican-aligned U.S. Chamber of Commerce came out and said this is, quote, contrary to fundamental American principles and the best interests of our country.
Right. And yet Congress won't be able to fix this because they're Congress. And the executive branch has made its decision because it can, because, as we said before, thanks, Obama. And I just think that's really interesting. So we were talking offline before we actually came into the studio about what corporate America can actually do. And you did a little digging on lobbying numbers.
I did. I think I don't know how many tweets you got, but I retweeted the thing. So it's so sad to have a little conversation about the Russian doll nest of tweets that occurred and then make that into an actual conversation. Dear God, I'm embarrassed for myself. However, there were comments about, so Tim Cook tweeted that, you know, 250 Dreamers work for Apple and that they are very much in support of DACA, which caused someone else to say, well, you've got $250 billion in the bank. What are you going to do about it?
Right.
And when I retweeted that, there I have unwound the nest.
also,
several people responded.
You're back on Twitter.
I think I'm, yeah, I am. Yeah. Which will, because I have a show now.
I know.
You gotta be.
I know.
I can't. I mean, another one. This one at least was weekly, so I could catch up more slowly, and now I can't anymore.
Yeah.
But no less a figure than Joe Nocera from the New York Times responded to that original tweet and said, okay, well, so what can a company do? What do you expect Tim Cook to do? Because it's not his $250 billion.
Right.
And so that led us to ask the question, okay, what are the levers? If a company, you know, what can, other than signing petitions and coming out forcefully and making statements and thoughts and prayers,
yep.
What are the levers that can be pulled? And we basically landed on lobbying.
Yeah. Yeah. And the interesting part of this is that Apple spent something like, what, $2.2 million in the most recent quarter or most recent year? Most recent quarter, right?
Quarter.
Quarter, mm-hmm. Right? $2.2 million from Apple, the most valuable company on the planet. And that they spent basically couch change on lobbying. And it's really interesting, sort of the line that corporate America treads between lobbying / influence purchasing, right? Fiduciary responsibility and all the rest of it. And I think it's really interesting that corporate America now has an issue that it feels really, really strongly about. And it will be fascinating to see what it, using the collective noun, does.
Right. Well, and in that past quarter, Apple alone, so Google, Apple, Amazon, and Uber have all hit lobbying records in just this past quarter, this most recent quarter. And Apple's previous record came the quarter before that. So it has definitely increased its lobbying spending significantly since President Trump took office. But it's really interesting because if you look at the $2.2 million that it spent in the past quarter, issues related to immigration, including high-skilled immigration, is the last item on the list.
As in least amount
and
spent.
As in the least amount spent.
Right.
Above that is general patent reform, general copyright issues, issues related to music licensing, general education technology funding, issues related to digital textbooks, and so on and so forth. So
that's interesting.
It remains I would argue it remains a perfectly fair question to say, to any of these companies, okay, what are you doing? And this is something that came up during the last days of the American Healthcare Act debate.
Yep.
Where are the insurance companies? If they really want to have an impact, where is their money? Because in all my digging this morning, I'm 99% certain that there are, in fact, no federal laws, that no SEC regulations, nothing that impacts how much a company can spend on lobbying as a percentage. If you're a nonprofit and you spend more than 20% of your revenue on lobbying, then you have to register as a for-profit company. No similar regulation exists for a publicly held or a private company. Right. So in theory, Tim Cook, as the CEO of Apple, could say, we're going to spend, I don't know, 10% of our cash reserves, 20% of our cash reserves on lobbying on this one issue. And that would be a pretty big lever.
Yeah, well, they'd have to pay 35% tax on it to bring it back into this country, but that's a whole different thing.
Well, there's that. Maybe what they still really want.
Would you? That's actually a fascinating thing. Would you send me that breakdown of the hierarchy of their spending? Because I'm going to make that today's file.
Yeah,
that's
in fact, we should totally put this on the internet.
That is.
Whoa, we'll put this on our website.
That is crazy.
But yeah.
So yeah,
and
you know.
All of this is available because there are regulations that say, I mean, so you do have to disclose. So this is where you get into the fiduciary duty, right? On the one hand, Tim Cook could direct Apple to spend as much money as it wants on lobbying and the issues that it thinks are really important. There are some limits that come from the other side. There are limits on how much a politician can receive. So it might be like, what's that movie where, is it the Richard Pryor movie where he has to spend $30 million in... Brewster's Millions.
Also, I'm just dating myself right there.
Apparently, I did too,
yeah, right?
But with poorer recall. But it's sort of like that, right? There may be, in fact, a limit from the other side, a limiting factor on how much a company can spend on lobbying because you have to disclose it, and then that gets your shareholders upset. There's only so much you can actually give to an individual politician or organization. It might be that you can't actually engage in unlimited spending on the lobbying side, but really, it seems like the major limit is just whether your consumers are having that or not, or whether your shareholders are having that.
Yeah. And you have to believe the board at Apple supports Tim Cook in his public postures and stances on issues of the day. Otherwise, he wouldn't be the CEO anymore. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I looked back at what the health industry did, you know, the insurers and medical organizations eventually did come off the bench in the health debate. But this, I found this in a political story. It was, quote, The lobbying effort still pales in comparison to the, quote, scorched earth tactics of the health insurance industry that derailed former President Bill Clinton's proposed health care overhaul more than two decades ago. So business has levers, and they're powerful. And in fact, everywhere else, every story about lobbying is, you know, corporations have too much influence on our politics. So as far as I'm concerned, it's still in our ongoing conversation about the checks and balances.
Well,
it's still thoughts and prayers. Until they start to spend the money.
Well, see, now this is so interesting, right? Because I was about to bring up the whole checks and balances thing and businesses as a balance and a check. But this is actually policy advocacy as opposed to the things that were happening earlier, which were more within the realm of what's the right word? Of proper balance, I guess. I don't know. I'm a little at sea on that one, but
no, anyway. I think you're totally right. I mean, it's where's the line? Because it's true that public pressure does matter. So it's not totally fair for me to say, you know, until you spend the money, it doesn't matter. But actions matter more than words.
Right.
But then the other really interesting factor that I'd be considering if I were a giant transnational, you know, company is the behaviors of our government at this moment, the sort of systematic dismantling of the federal government infrastructure, which is a stated goal of this administration, is only accelerating the power of companies. And I think, you know, every dystopian vision of the future, even in like Futurama, involves, oh, they're one of America's eight companies, involves increasing consolidation and power by corporations over our lives. And when you look at the Hurricane Harvey response and how it becomes incumbent on Walmart to come in with supplies if FEMA's not there. And it becomes a sort of maybe a slight, only slightly virtuous cycle for Walmart. They like provide a lot of supplies, but also make a lot of money on the back end. You just start to realize that the companies will become more important than governments and that the CEOs will become more important than politicians in some ways. And the more power our government turns over to private industry, the faster we end up on that path.
Yep. Totally. All right. So having chewed that one over a bit, anything else we want to say on that? Because there's other stuff we want to get to here.
I know. I mean, I guess the only other thing I found funny today was that the only other business lever that there is to pull apparently is to cancel your Mar-a-Lago party. Because David Fahrenthold.
Is there a new thing happening?
David Fahrenthold at the Washington Post has been gradually covering all of the galas that had been planned at Mar-a-Lago and now have been canceled. And I think the last one, maybe no, there's still some. The Bethesda Hospital Foundation moved it over the weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. This is David Fahrenthold of the Post, who keeps that yellow pad of good old fashioned shoe leather reporting notes.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. But we do have an interesting when we look at Congress's long list of things to do this month.
Well, all right.
So, I did add one thing to it.
I know. I saw that tweet. I was going to let it go, but now that you're bringing it up, so there's DACA and the debt limit and hurricane relief and this and that, and then Molly Wood today tweeted and net neutrality.
Net neutrality, obviously.
Hey, man, everybody's got their issues.
There's also the future of the internet at stake.
Now, perhaps you could tell us why you believe that to be true. That they got
this came up because today, September 5th, Tuesday, September 5th, marks my first official day as host of Marketplace Tech, our tech broadcast and accompanying podcast. And our first interview was with FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, who we have talked about a lot on this show. And in asking him about net neutrality, there's no reason for me to litigate net neutrality with Ajit Pai when his position is super clear and the position of consumers is this and the whatever. What I really want to know is, when are we going to get this conversation away from the FCC at all? Because Ajit Pai is the third FCC commissioner that I personally have interviewed about net neutrality and broadband infrastructure. And in however many, God help us, years that is, it hasn't gotten that much better. And there is now a sort of emerging conversation, which is maybe this is something that Congress needs to take up, because there needs to be a lasting regulatory framework so that the idea of an open internet doesn't just ping pong back and forth between what are increasingly partisan FCC chairmen or people, chairs. So we had that conversation. You can hear it. You may hear it on the radio, but you know, I'm sure you're listening to this days later. So subscribe to the podcast, because you get a longer version of all those interviews. And we're on iTunes. I'm working on Google Play. So it's most of the places you like to podcast. And it's very excited. I'm very excited. I'm just excited.
Yeah.
So we're going to play a little bit of that interview, some that did not air on the broadcast and won't, because it's sort of more current. And then a little bit about... a little bit about what it feels like for Ajit Pai to be the most hated man on the internet. So I asked him two questions. One that you'll hear about his relationship with President Trump, and I thought that his answer was very illuminating. And then the other one about, you know, look, I had this conversation with this guy. It was, you know, 30 or 40 minutes long. He's super personable and genial and relaxed and smiley, and he's got a really big coffee cup. And it seemed so incongruous, because if you look online, people describe him as Darth Vader. It's like a little call ahead to our Tim Leong thing. But so here's a little bit of that.
We are obviously in this moment of intense political rhetoric. President Trump said things that have alienated him from the business community. How does, if at all, that rhetoric from the president affect your ability to, you know, conduct business within the FCC?
Well, I'm always focused on my job. I have so much to do across the different areas that we regulate in terms of internet access or consumer protection or public safety. And so actually, by and large, the FCC, as an independent agency, we've always been focused on the mission. And thus far, we've been able to do it working with members of Congress and the administration and the public pretty well.
It seems like... I try to not live my entire life on Twitter, it seems like you're very...
I've not been as successful as you can tell.
Yeah, I took it off my phone, and it's like the greatest thing I ever did.
Right.
You seem very insulated from the storm. I mean, people are concerned. Like, I think consumers are worried that the FCC's taken a different tone, that there's a really different kind of rhetoric. People are just worried about the future of the internet, right? Setting aside everything else that's going on.
Right.
Do you see that? Do you feel that?
I understand there's some issues that are going to be exceptionally controversial, and that's the way it is under any FCC. But we're going to keep focused on the important missions that we've got here, you know, closing the digital divide, preserving the free and open internet, protecting consumers, promoting public safety. And I think over time, these results will speak for themselves. And I'm confident that some of that controversy will fade into the background.
So two things about that tape. Yeah. One, I thought it was really interesting. I think it's really interesting at this point in this administration, when you ask someone in the administration who has taken a similar line as the president on many issues, you know, how are you feeling about how all of this is going? And he just says, hey, man, I don't talk to him. I'll just put my head down and do my job. No, well, no full-throated defense of...
Just to get back to the theme, right? There's normal and not normal. And what is happening at the FCC is within the bounds of a normal Republican administration. Right?
Yes.
Millions and millions of people might not like it, and corporate America might be, you know, confused or whatever, but it's not outside the norms, as opposed to many other things that are happening in this government. I think we'll just leave
it. Yeah, exactly. Right? And I think Ajit Pai was very specifically saying, I would just like to be normal.
Hmm.
I did ask him also, you heard. Yeah. He just said, I don't want to I don't want to talk about that guy,
yeah.
which is really interesting, right? His, I feel like there's a possibility that in a more normal situation, you would have your FCC chairman say, look, we're in the same party. We represent the same goals. Yep. And he was just like, hey, man, I'm just doing my job. And also with respect to, are you in fact the most hated man on the internet? And how do you feel about that? I will be vindicated in the end, which is just like tape. I just want everyone to hear and judge for themselves.
Man, POTUS who? All right, let us know what you think. Write to us, makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can go to our website. It's makemesmart.org. Or now that she's back on Twitter, because she's got a show, at Molly Wood is where you can tweet her. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl. I'm just saying.
I'm just going to, it's like a total spoiler, but we have an interview coming up in a future episode of Make Me Smart that really did make me think differently about the Twitter. If you want to be part of our editorial meetings, have some input on what we cover in the show and how, check us out on Facebook. That is on Mondays at 12 noon Pacific. That is on our Facebook pages, facebook.com/KaiRizdahl and facebook.com/MollyWood. If you follow those pages, Facebook will tell you when we're going live, but it's important to note that you do not have to be on Facebook to watch. You can actually still see the live stream. You just have to tweet us questions instead of putting them in the comments.
Next up, Luke, I am your father. I'm kidding. It's not really, you know, Darth Vader, but
that was
nerdy. But it's close. Star Wars, infographics-wise, straight ahead.
So this guy, Tim Leong, is the creative director at one of my favorite magazines. We've been getting this magazine at my house since I was,
really?
I don't know, probably in high school, I think. My mom was subscribing to it. Entertainment Weekly, which means he's the guy who helps envision and create those sort of just wonderful and really iconic covers. And he handles a lot of the design of the magazine also. And on top of all of that, creates books filled with these amazing infographics about pop culture. So we are going to talk a little bit about data visualization and why it's important, but we basically got him on the phone because, and I discovered in this process, everybody knows I'm a giant nerd, but it turns out that one Kai Rizdahl kind of is too, a little bit of a Star Wars geek.
We started, as we usually do, with the basic question. Here you go.
What is an infographic? What is its purpose? How did you find this love in your heart for this format?
So infographics, right, it's information graphics. It's this marriage between information and visuals. So kind of putting them together and trying to help tell a story in a visual way. So this is like my second infographic book. My first one, when I was at Wired magazine, I was kind of going through a creative dry spell. And I was like, what kind of side project can I take on? And I was like, oh, I know infographics and I know comic books. I'm trying to put those together.
So why'd you go with Star Wars, man?
I think the question is, why wouldn't you go with Star Wars?
Yeah.
If you had to do a book of, you know, hundreds of infographics about any one subject, I think Star Wars is the one that you would want. I think what's great about Star Wars and what made this easier for me is that Star Wars is just full of this great visual iconography, whether it's like helmets or lightsabers. There's all these great colors and uniforms and backgrounds that are just burned into people's memories. And if you see any of these visuals, you know automatically it's going to be Star Wars related. So they just opened up this whole world for me to really play with that made the design a lot easier because if you're playing off these iconic visuals, half that understanding is already there.
So I'll tell you what. I know from a chart on page 174, it's a bar graph, conveniently color-coded, as are most things in this book, that the movies run 17 hours and 4 minutes, the TV shows run 62 hours, 33 minutes, novels 81 hours, 36 minutes, and the comic books 18 hours, 10 minutes. Did you go through all of that content to figure this out?
Most of it. Not all of it. I'll be honest, not all of it.
Wow.
Kai, where'd you... I feel like Jon Snow up here. I know nothing.
Yeah, I need a different job.
My wife was really afraid that I wouldn't like Star Wars after this because I'd just been so deep into it. But actually, I think the opposite was true. Like, it gave me a greater appreciation for Star Wars. That there was actually so much stuff. And the universe is so big. And there's so many details and so many layers and levels that it actually gave me a greater appreciation for Star Wars.
Can I just real quickly, the scope here, in addition to the comic books and novels and all that, the scope here is movies 1 through 7, right?
That's the primary.
Just to establish the parameters. Okay, all right. Yep. So I shouldn't ask you about Rogue One then.
You certainly can. It's in there. This was actually due the day Rogue One came out. That was when I had so I watched it night at like the midnight show and then came home and designed as many charts as I could.
Oh, that's great. That's great, actually.
The thing I find amazing was the one graphic that shows sort of the entire timeline that includes like the comic books and the novels and the TV shows. I sort of thought, okay, if I'm ever off work for 3 months, I'm just going to consume those, you know, start to finish, because then you fill in all of that detail that's all implied in the movies.
I think that's, you know, the hard thing about Star Wars is because there's so much stuff, right? You talked about all those books and movies and games and comics, and it's just hard to kind of put it all together. It's just so big. So that's why I thought that chart was really helpful. And big props to Lucasfilm for helping figure out all that stuff.
Yeah,
I think it'd be impossible to parse otherwise.
I think it's interesting, actually, that the identities are so strong, whether it's the colors or the fonts or the crawl at the front. I mean, you see that crawl and you know exactly what's going on. And it all actually speaks to, in a way, the brand identity of the Star Wars franchise, which has been so carefully cultivated through the years by Lucas and now Disney.
Absolutely. And who knew that back then? Before brand identity was, right? You know, a really common thing. But I think you're totally right. The opening crawl, the music, I have a bad feeling about this.
Which is an infographic, it's a whole thing. You lay out how many times people say, I have a bad feeling about this.
And like how bad it really is.
Yeah. It happens every film.
Yeah. Do you have respect for that as a design guy, as a graphic designer? Do you think like, man, the discipline here is really noticeable and impressive?
Absolutely. I mean, the visuals and thought that has gone into this is just really unbelievable. I think the one thing that I saw maybe 2 years ago was like explaining the mechanics of the Millennium Falcon and why it kind of has this U front and has like the cockpit window on one side. It's because that ship is used as for like freight hauling and like pushing storage. So that U, it kind of like holds
really
the shipping containers.
Wow.
And the cockpit is on one side. So you can still see out, so that shipping container isn't blocking the view. It's just like really, really intelligent design.
Wow, get out.
It's impressive.
It's like they were doing design thinking before design thinking was even a thing. That's amazing.
All right. Fun trivia question. Who says, or as you say in this chart on page 40, who name drops Force the most in the Star Wars films? Obi-Wan or Yoda? This is a test, Tim, to see how well you remember your material.
Oh, maybe Yoda?
Yoda it is, 19 to 18.
Oh, that's great.
So, Tim, about Star Wars or otherwise, this question can encompass your entire life. What is something you thought you knew, but it turned out you were wrong about?
The non-Star Wars answer would be, I think it sounds very soft and kind of fluffy to be equating success with happiness. Like in your job and in your career, I always thought I could just like try to go be like a kick-ass designer and just do really cool stuff. And the longer I work, the more I've definitely come to realize that's not quite true, that like real success has to do with happiness in your job. And being happy in your workplace, I never thought that was a real thing. And I thought that was just like something parents told kids. But it's so true. I was so wrong. And I think the people you work with, it's almost more important than the job itself.
Let's be fair, though. That's a guy with a pretty good gig.
Yeah, he does have a pretty good gig. Jig? He might have a jig, but he's got a good gig, too. Yeah, that's, it's a great book to flip through and just check stuff out with. That's what I thought.
Oh, absolutely. Like, bring it with the kids.
Yep.
We put a couple of those graphics up on makemesmart.org. But we also wanted to try an experiment. Our producer, Jenny Justin, had the idea to try out an audio version of his infographic. So he made one that's called Luke's Questions, which really made me laugh a lot. You'll see it up on the site. I'm not going to spoil it for you until after. But it's a graph of every single question that Luke Skywalker asks in the original Star Wars trilogy. And Tim will take it from here.
So Luke Skywalker, you know, is our central character in Star Wars. And I think he's also the person that has the biggest character development arc throughout the films. You know, I was trying to figure out, how do we graph that? My first thought was visually in what he wears. But I thought that might be too obvious. So I thought another way was to be breaking down how many questions he asks through the films. And in episode 4, he asks like 60-something, you know, it's like,
what about that one?
You know, the rebellion against the Empire? Have you been in many battles?
What's this?
Who is she?
Ben Kenobi?
Huh?
3PO?
Bastard Biggs, where are you?
And then in Empire Strikes Back, it's maybe like a third as many questions.
Hano, buddy, do you read me?
R2, what are we doing here?
How far away is Yoda? Will it take us long to get there?
Will they die?
Why didn't you tell me?
And through the progression of the story, it kind of evolves into him helping other people and getting people to help him throughout his journey.
Is Darth Vader my father? A certain point of view?
What, she didn't come back?
Han, can you reach my lightsaber?
Do you understand anything they're saying? Do you remember your mother? Your real mother?
And then in episode 7, he doesn't say anything at all. No questions. And then I think in episode 8, he's not going to be asking questions. Instead, he'll be answering questions.
All right, see, that's a good insight, and I love that supercut, and I think it's an awesome train of thought. I will say, however, I disagree with the premise. Anakin Skywalker goes from normal dude to the embodiment of evil. And we're saying Luke has a bigger freaking character arc? I don't know.
I'm fascinating.
Just saying, right? Come on. I mean, I get the thing. You go from newbie to
legit.
You go from newbie to wise Jedi, right? And that last scene in the last movie where he's like reaching out for the lightsaber or whatever the hell it is with
totally.
Right? But Anakin Skywalker goes from reasonable dude to death. Come
on. To totally genocidal maniac.
Right.
That is fascinating, and I think you have just uncovered a pretty serious original trilogy bias in this book.
I will say, though,
about that infographic in particular, the thing that made me laugh so hard about it is that at least three of the questions, you know, constantly are, what? What?
Well, yeah.
And then, the one that occurs the most commonly, which I literally laughed out loud and made a note about it during the interview, was 3PO. 3PO?
Yeah.
3PO? 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 Like all through this chart, it says it. 3PO? And I was like, I'm not sure that counts as a question, but it's still really funny. Tim Leung's book, The Star Wars Super Graphics, is out right now.
More from you next, but we got to pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
All right, book group team. Don't forget we're reading The Man in the High Castle as our next selection in the Make Me Smart book club. I'm not going to lie. I knocked out a whole big chunk of that book over the weekend because we had, which I feel like I can't even complain about when LA is on fire and Montana is on fire and, you know, Texas is underwater and so is Louisiana, but it was really hot. It was the hottest day. In San Francisco, though, it was the hottest day ever.
Oh, is that right?
On record.
Oof.
Yeah. I mean, it was great. It was, you know, well over 100
and all that jazz,
yeah. Right here on the coast, which was intense. Anyway, I spent one whole day holed up in my bedroom, which is my one air conditioned room. But I read like 300 pages of the book, or no, 200 pages. Wow. 100, anyway, a bunch. And it is fascinating. It is a fascinating read. And it's also just all of the perspective and path dependency questions that it raises that's the kind of thing I'm obsessed with.
Brass tacks, path dependency.
I love this. I love it.
I know you
like
do.
This is my like nerd obsession. It's just but for a few little actions here and there. I'm going to stop calling it that because you know what it is? Chaos theory.
Boom. Oh, well, we're going to do a whole show on chaos theory.
I think that show could almost be this show. Our Make Me Smart book club show could be the chaos theory show. But yes, we totally decided that. I saw it in the Slack. We will be talking about this book, The Man in the High Castle, in early October. So if you haven't started reading yet, go get it. It's actually a pretty fast read. So get it at the library or your Kindle. Or I bought a paper one. I bought the real book.
So did I.
All right, next up, you guys.
Where do we mail a letter?
So last week, in the midst of Harvey and Houston and all that, we talked to a guy by the name of Sam Brody. He is a professor of marine sciences and urban planning at Texas A&M University in Galveston. We got him at home in Houston, where he'd been cooped up for days and days and days, as he told us, if you remember. He was tired, but he spent a lot of time, relatively speaking, talking to us about why Houston happens to flood so very much. Charlie Fitzpatrick heard that. He wrote us, and he is a former geography teacher, and so he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, and he said this: Sam Brody provided much wisdom, and I half expected him to say a line I've used for decades. This indicates inadequate attention to geography education. Mm-hmm. Sam talked about growth and smart cities. That takes understanding, which takes education, of people of all ages, backgrounds, and life roles. I very much enjoyed your segment today, as tired as Sam was and as dark as the days may be. Sometimes people learn from a little bump. Sometimes people need a big bump. Sadly, sometimes not enough people learn quickly enough, and many suffer unnecessarily. Hopefully we will learn what's where, why it is there, and so what.
So, you know, it's interesting.
That was really poetic.
It was really poetic. But what's interesting is everybody was thinking as Harvey was happening and these terrible things were being seen on television and the suffering, and then the communal spirit that helped so many people. And now here we are with Congress back in Washington, and it's all going to hell. I'm just saying.
Oh, come on, man.
No? Should I not? All right. Well, was that too much nothing
matters?
Do
you think it's really going to?
I don't know. All right, fine.
I will say, I am discovering in myself a well of optimism that I did not know was there. And that, frankly, I think my friends are starting to find kind of annoying.
Wow. Okay.
Apparently, I want to believe.
But there's a Tinkerbell
so I will.
Somewhere, but...
I know. Give me like a sparkle. Play me out with a sparkle.
Is there a sparkle? We should find a sparkle. Anyway.
Please keep talking to us. We got a lot of wonderful email, including at least one person who was like, how could you interview that poor man, you mean bastard? Because poor Sam was so tired.
He was so tired.
He was so poor Peanut. I just wanted to hug him. Anyway, please keep listening. Subscribe if you don't already. Leave us reviews on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends. Go subscribe to Marketplace Tech. It's super short.
That says the brand new host, Marketplace Tech. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Robert Garova, Emily Henderson, and the senior producer, Nancy Fargali. This week's program, engineered by Jake Gorski. Our theme music is composed by Ben Tolliday, who's on a fellowship, and Daniel Ramirez, who's got the good duty in London this week. Holy cow.
Dang. The executive producer of Marketplace is Satara Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And I'm just saying that both Daniel and Ben have earned it.
They totally have. They totally have. That is true.
Those guys are great. They're all great.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.